coming in, gold and a world record. Ian Thorpe,
the birth of a legend.
458 is the total, out of which Bradman has made 309 not out. It's a world's record.
Ball in Test cricket in England for Shane Warne. And he's done it. He started off with the most beautiful delivery. Yes!
Australia have got it! Yes! Australia is back on the biggest stage.
Welcome to This Is Your Sporting Life for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Here's your host, Sam Edmund.
Welcome to the show. As always, we're here for our friends at Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Well, today we're joined by a former tennis pro and one of Australia's most experienced sports administrators. Paul McNamee won 2 singles titles, 23 doubles titles on the court before shaping the game in this country off it. Order of Australia medalist, King of Moomba, Cox Plate winning owner, author, business owner. There's not much this man hasn't done. Paul, it's only a 45-minute show. Welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Sam. I hope I won't bore you.
No chance of that. You're 66 years young. I've got to say, though, you have crammed a lot into those 66 years, Paul.
Yeah, there's more to come. Don't worry. I mean, today, I look at today more than yesterday or even tomorrow. Happy to be speaking to you. And, you know, let's try and make this interesting for the listeners. But, you know, life is a great opportunity, and I'm happy just to be part of it.
Oh, that's great. What a great attitude to have looking forward and looking day to day. Speaking of day to day, sounds like you're in a good place, obviously. Someone who, unfortunately, isn't in a great place at the moment, Paul, and I'm sure you've watched this with as much interest as the rest of us, and maybe even sadness, is, of course, the situation involving Naomi Osaka, who this week pulled out of the French Open after the circus-like response that came from her refusal to speak to the media. What have you made it all over there?
Look, it is sad. I mean, we obviously, our first thoughts are to Naomi to be able to get on top of, you know, the bouts of depression that she's dealing with. And that must be hard when you're the highest paid female athlete in history. And yet that doesn't mean you're immune from, mental problems. So our thoughts go out to her. I mean, she admitted she probably could have handled it a little better. And I think the Grand Slam board could have handled it a little bit better as well. And I think it's relatively new on the table, dealing with mental illnesses of athletes, but it's absolutely real. It's just that you can't see it like an injury. You see someone, you know, sprain their ankle or do their knee, but you don't see the mental anguish that athletes are going through. So I think it's put a spotlight on that and for the better. And I think AFL and many other codes are dealing with it, and it needed the spotlight. And I think that's the positive to come out of it.
Yeah. You mentioned both sides could have handled it better. And certainly the statement from the presidents of the 4 Grand Slam tennis tournaments did raise some eyebrows. I mean, you were obviously involved at the highest level at the Australian Open for what, a dozen years. If you were over there in Paris, how do you think you would have handled this hot potato?
Well, I think it was there in a difficult position because after I've just been watching the interview on Monica Seles, which is incredible because, I mean, no one played tennis, female women's tennis better, I think, than Monica Seles, but that's another point. But, when Naomi came out and said that I'm not going to do any media conferences, when she announced that before the tournament, and then she plays a match, does an on-court interview, and then doesn't want to go to the press, the tournament director, you know, and the president of the French Federation, the new president, Gilles Moreton, they tried to reach out and speak to Naomi Osaka and her manager, and were not able to do so. I mean, that was the hard part, and I think that Naomi perhaps would regret, is that they did make an effort to reach her and to discuss what she was going through in vain. And so, of course, then they threw the book at her with the fine. I mean, $15,000 is a lot of money for missing a media conference. It seems over the top, of course. But I think they were in a difficult position, and they had to fine her when she said she's not going to do a media conference, wouldn't speak to them, and then didn't do it. So I think they had no choice but to fine her. Maybe their language could have been better. But they were trying to figure out what's going on here. I mean, even people close to Naomi did not know. You know, people within the WTA and then Chris Evans and Martin Navratilova, they were not aware of these problems she was going through. So I think they were in a very, very tough position. And so I think the fine was understandable. And, of course, when Naomi then admitted what she's going through, of course, you know, a lot of people did a 180 degree very quickly because they, oh my goodness.
Yeah, yeah. I mentioned your author status, Paul. You've got, obviously, Game Changer, My Tennis Life, but you've just released a new book. It's on the shelves at the moment. Tell us what it's called and what it's all about.
It's called Welcome to the Dance because it's the joy of being able to make a tennis ball dance, and especially on a clay court where you learn the nuances of the game, and you learn to, if you care about it, you learn to unlock the mysteries of the game. And so my premise is that to truly master tennis, you need to master clay. And I feel sadness for people that don't go on that journey, the one that I went on, and it's a joyous journey. And that's the end result is, you know, being able to make a tennis ball dance and the fulfillment that you get out of that.
Yeah. Yeah. Your passion for clay is well known, Paul. It does chart your experiences on the surface. But the best part of it, I think, is your documentation of the win over Mac, John McEnroe, centre court at the French Open. I think you won 246 matches across your singles career. But am I right in saying you regard this as the absolute pick of them?
Well, not so much because you're winning a third round match at a Grand Slam. I mean, you know, a lot of people, you know, I made a semi of the Australian Open, yep, which is arguably a better result. But no, the point for me was on Court Chatrier, I had played my first ever match on clay on that court when I played a guy over 40 years of age from South America. And I'm thinking, I'm the number one junior in Australia, one of the best juniors in the world. What is this guy even? Why is he still playing? Okay, it's not Roger Federer is still playing at 40. This is the guy over 40 from South America. And so I didn't think it was a difficult match. I mean, so what? It's my first match on clay. I mean, it's the same shape and size, right, of any other tennis court. It's a rectangle, right?
Mm-hmm.
78 feet by 27 feet. So, but, you know, he just took me to pieces. And I thought, well, if he does show me a bit of stuff I haven't seen before, like angles and drop shots, I'll just stay in a rally with the guy because I'm younger, fitter, stronger. But, of course, he knew that he's a step ahead. And this is the key about clay. You know, if you know your stuff, you're always a step ahead and you know how to dismantle somebody. So he could just stand there and dominate the chessboard. So I was the one doing all the running, which is the wrong thing to happen when I'm younger and fitter and stronger. So I quickly discovered that I knew so little about this surface, and that everyone who had said, oh, it's different, Paul, it's different. I'm like, yeah, okay, sure, it's different. What different? It's different, okay. It is different. And so I, you know, went on that journey. And so the next time I played on Court Chatrier was a third round of the French Open against John McEnroe, who's number two in the world. And, you know, he's kind of a genius as a player. He was the Federer of my generation. And it was not that I won the match. It was the way in which I did it that I was able to, you know, dismantle the number two in the world, because he was a little bit more uncomfortable on clay than what I was. And I knew my stuff and I had the answers. And so in terms of personal fulfillment, I never had a more fulfilling moment personally in my career than when I won that match. I was walking off the court knowing that I knew my stuff, and that every other player would know that I knew my stuff. So that was my rite of passage that happened at that moment as a player. And I knew all the Europeans who kind of a little bit the custodian of clay court tennis. I knew I would have that respect forever, which I still have there. So that's why that was so important for me.
And you had to hold your nerve, though, too, didn't you, Paul? Because four tie breaks, it went for 4 hours, sure, and 18 minutes as well.
Yeah, and of course, you know, John had game plan A, B, C. He could do anything. You know, he could serve volley if he wanted to. He could chip and charge if he wanted to. He could play in the court because he's got the hands of Federer, the way Federer now plays more inside the court, especially with the latest rackets, and especially on hard court. So he had all the different things that he could bring, and he loved to psych out his opponent as well. He loved to disrupt the match to get you thinking about other things besides the present. But I'd paid my dues, you know, and I knew what I was doing, and I knew my game had a chance of matching up against him on clay, which it did not on grass or hard, even though we played I won sets off him on those other surfaces, but I didn't beat him. But on clay, that was my turf, and in a way, you're defending the honour of clay, which is what Rafa does, which is why that final last year against against Novak Djokovic. He was defending the honour of clay. I mean, he is a better clay court player, and he can accept losing to Djokovic on hard court or grass. And he never loses to him now on hard court, by the way. But he cannot accept dishonouring clay by losing to him in a major final on clay. So that's how I felt, and I felt like that from then on. But I had to have that rite of passage, and I achieved that that day.
That's fascinating. And do you stay in touch as much as one can now, for obvious reasons, with John McEnroe, Paul? Have you got a relationship that's ongoing?
Absolutely. Well, he wrote the foreword to my book, Game Fantastic. Changer. Not Welcome to the Dance. I didn't get anyone to write a foreword to that. I just figured I wrote that thing on my phone, during COVID. So that's how I did it. I didn't even have a laptop to do the book.
Is that a torturous task or what?
What's that?
That would have been a torturous task. The thumbs would have been.
No, it was okay. You can be pretty quick on the phone. So, Johnny Mack, I have enormous respect for. And the reason I'm close to John is because of that match, because he came up to me the next week and said, how did you play like that against me? I mean, why does everybody bring their A game when they play me? That's not fair. There's no way, right? But he respected me because I've been him fair and square. It wasn't a lucky win. I put him through torture that day, trust me.
I love it. I love it. You're listening to This Is Your Sporting Life, thanks to Tobin Brothers Funerals, a family-owned business since 1934. Well, next, we'll revisit the rest of Paul's decorated tennis career and another close friend who played such a big part in it.
You're listening to This Is Your Sporting Life with Sam Edmund for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Welcome back to This Is Your Sporting Life for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Hello, great to have your company on This Is Your Sporting Life, made possible by Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. We're with former tennis star and sporting identity, Paul McNamee. Paul, we left the conversation with John McEnroe, of course, but you had another great friend on tour, and that was the late Peter McNamara, your doubles partner with whom you had so much success with. Sadly, he died of prostate cancer in July 2019.
Yeah, sadly, very sad. Macca loved life and was, he was talking about living in the present, Macca. And, he just loved the tour. He loved the sport. And we went back to junior days when he was, we were 13 years of age, playing juniors, the same age group. And he was kind of the joker, the comical act. I mean, no one took his tennis seriously, and then he beat me in the final of the juniors in Western Australia, and then everyone, wait, maybe the guy can play a little bit, because he just didn't seem like he was serious about it. But he had this amazing backhand that he could hit slice so well, and pass you with topspin, he had a beautiful looking game. And so we kind of went out, did our own thing a bit, and then we thought we should try and play some doubles together when we were about 21, 22. And, we just felt like our games would match up that way because, I had a better forehand, he had a better backhand. I served a bit better, he volleyed a bit better, and, he became a top 10 player, of course. But the key to doubles is finding someone that has, to be honest, the opposite strength in their game and the opposite personality in a way, because you need to complement each other. So someone constantly needs to take the lead role. Someone needs to feel the pressure at the start of the match, and someone needs to be able to handle it at the end of the match. So we kind of complemented each other so well. And just from the very first match, we were a perfect partnership in a way. And we were different guys, absolutely, on and off the court. But we just went on this run, and, in the limited time Peter had as a player, because we only played 3 years together, and in that time we won all those Grand Slams and tournaments in just 3 years, because Peter did his knee, in Rotterdam in 83 after, we only started playing together in 79. So, it's maximum 4 years we had together, and we did a lot. People think we played for 20 years. We didn't. Was only three to 4 years maximum until Macca did his knee, and that effectively was the end of his career.
Yeah, you won three of your four, obviously, doubles, Grand Slam titles with him by your side. It was 79, as you said, the Australian Open, and then 82 at Wimbledon. And you were known as the Supermax, of course, Paul. And, I mean, sport is a business, and the athletes these days are often business-like, but how much of it was just fun with Pete?
Well, it was because we never thought about ourselves as doubles players. I mean, now there's this whole thing where people think I was a doubles player. I never thought of myself as a doubles player. I mean, in fact, I took it off my... I tacked it off my Twitter.
Why?
Because, well, my brother, you know, he said, look, you know, people will think you couldn't play, you know, if you were a doubles player. So I kind of almost don't admit that I won all those Grand Slams and got to number one in the world. I've said it now, but I mean, it's think, oh, you were just a doubles player. My nephew was one of the best juniors in Australia, and he actually said, Uncle, did you actually play singles? I said, mate, when you get the semis of a Grand Slam, you know, you can ask me that question again, okay? You know, in singles. So,
fair enough.
So, you know, we were tennis players, and we'd base our schedule completely on singles, never around doubles. And then, but of course, we'd get together big tournaments like Monte Carlo. Why not? You know, what a tournament to play on the clay, and you know the French Riviera. There's parties and things going on at that time of the year, and just the whole ambience and vibe in Europe when the sun's coming out in the Mediterranean area. These are just magical times. So Macca and I, we had some great, great times together, and we were, you know, probably closer than ever, you know, at the end, you know, when it was clear he didn't want to admit that the end of his life was coming, but and he didn't want people to know, but it was obvious that this great physical specimen, good-looking guy was fading away. It was tough to see that.
Yeah, it's tragic, wasn't it? Paul, let's go back. You're born in Melbourne, November 12, 1954. Where was home as a kid?
In Essendon, North Essendon, Strathmore. Apparently, Buller Road was one of the busiest roads in Melbourne. I used to go up and down on a scooter when my parents weren't watching at 3 or 4 years of age, which is a shocker. But, you know, you couldn't do that now on a main street in Melbourne. And neighbours would drag me in because I thought it was great going up and down the road on a scooter, you know. It reminds me of the first time I went to Beijing, you know, when Australians just weren't going there as athletes. It was a sort of a friendship mission. And you know, there was 6 lanes, the bike lanes on a road, and 1 lane for the cars, you know. And then the next time I went to Beijing many, many years later, because there were 6 lanes of cars for cars and 1 lane for bikes. I mean, the whole thing changed dramatically. So, yeah, and you know, I used to just get the scooter up to the local tennis club, Dudagala, where my mum is still alive, turning 100 this year, which is amazing. And she finally became president of the Dudagala Bowls Club at 90. I mean, we think she's the oldest first-time president of anything.
When's her birthday, Paul? That's magnificent.
Yeah, look, it's December the 9th. You know, look, that's why we don't tempt fate because, you know, she's going well, but, you know, like, talk about living in the present. Every day is a good day for my mum.
So, of course, you were raised in Essendon because you had an uncle who had a reasonable example to set, didn't he, when it came to elite-level sport. He won a few Brownlows.
Yeah, he won 3. Look, Dick Reynolds was his name, and my mum was Mary Reynolds, Pixie. You know, they called her Pixie because she was so little when she was born. But Uncle Dick, yeah, he heard he'd won the Brownlow on the radio. I mean, there wasn't this big thing with all the wags and everything, you know, the crown, whatever. I mean, he heard on the radio he'd won the Brownlow. They had some function, but he wasn't invited because no one thought he had any chance. It was only his second year. I mean, he'd grown up loving Carlton. The whole family were mad Carlton supporters. But when his dad, you know, took him to Carlton at 16, they said, oh, you know, he was too scrawny, even though he could run even time as a sprinter. I mean, the guy was an amazing athlete. I'll come back when you grow up. So, his father was so upset, you know, that someone said, oh, take him down to Essendon. Essendon put him in the first the next week. I mean, they were mad Carlton people. I mean, you should never have played for Essendon, right? So, and a lot of people don't know that story. And then they gave him when he was a bit older, they gave him a job, you know, because, you know, there was no money then. He made like 6 pence a week or something. So they gave him, you know, he did the milk run around Essendon, you know. So he on a horse, not a car. He'd be driving the horse with the milk on the back. And at Essendon Station, when they used to, at Mooney Ponds there, where they, the gate, the guy'd come out and open the gate. You know, you remember those days. I remember them. You wouldn't, but I do. And he got the horse's head stuck through the fence, the paling of the fence of the gates at Moonee Ponds there, and so he couldn't drive the horse anymore. You know, I mean, this was what it was like back then, and his career was amazing. He played 320 games. He played the most games at that time, and became a great coach as well. And you know, and I remember seeing Dick, you know, kick the ball at training down at Essendon when he was coach. You know, so. Yeah, but he was such a gentleman. I'm seriously. I mean, he was. They called him King Richard. I mean, he was so regal. He was so gentlemanly. I mean, and you know, he was just that sort of a guy. I mean, his brother Tom. People didn't realize he had a brother Tom, who was, you know, who became full forward for Victoria, and he kicked the most number of goals at the time, 7 goals, that held the record for a long time in a grand final. That was his brother Tom, and Tom was a larrikin. And Tom ended up at the end of his career getting traded to St Kilda, and you know, and apparently, you know, Dick was playing, Essendon was playing against St Kilda, so his younger brother Dick's playing for Essendon, and he loved his younger brother, and someone from St Kilda flattened Dick, you know, in the game, and Tom went up to his own teammate St Kilda and ironed him out. He said, "Don't you ever do that to my brother again."
Right?
And Dick was on the opposition team. Right?
Unreal.
Don't you ever do that to my brother, right? And that was the last game Tom played for St Kilda, but, you know, blood's thicker than water. He was not going to let someone do that to his brother.
That's just unreal, isn't it? And coming back to you, you know, you're seeing all this as a youngster, you know, hearing all the old stories. So I guess it's so powerful, the message, isn't it? When did your relationship with the game of tennis first start then, Paul? Can you recall a moment?
It was a dude at Gullah just mucking around. You know, there was, you know, 30, 40 kids getting on three courts and just was free-balling tennis. There was no scoring, or you just went up there and hung out with the other kids and just balls would be shooting everywhere, you know. And that was my – and mum and dad, you know, dad – my dad was a really good athlete. He played VFA football, which at that time was as big as, you know, as the VFL, which became AFL. And he was just a great all-round athlete. And so he – you know, he let me play. They let me play any sport I wanted. But, you know, people say to children, oh, you know, which sport should you get them into, and you know, which sport should they choose? And I say this, you don't choose the sport, actually. The sport chooses you. It grabs you because that's the one you've got some talent in or you've got love. But, you know, tennis grabbed me. It wasn't because I particularly chose tennis. It was tennis chose me in a way because that was the one that was saying, hey, this is for you.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I loved golf as well. They were my two favorite sports and still are, by the way. But I didn't like the fact that I couldn't run around in golf. Now I do, by the way. But at the time, you know, I just loved the athleticism that tennis brought. And so it grabbed me. And then I got into the junior thing, and I played a lot of tennis in the country. And my favourite memories as a child are really in the Tarnagullah area, the Golden Triangle, where my dad found a nugget of gold, a 70-ounce nugget of gold in the Depression in 1931, which is amazing. So I got that. My childhood, every weekend, every summer holidays, we'd go to that area up near Bendigo, and we'd go to Bridgewater every afternoon in summer and go swimming there in the river, which I did again recently, you know, which was amazing. But they had these lawn courts at Bridgewater. They don't have them anymore. And, you know, we would play on the grass, you know, in bare feet. I mean, we didn't have tennis shoes. We'd just play in bare feet. And I just remember, you know, never having tennis shoes and just playing in bare feet on the grass, which you could. And, you know, I love that. So they're my memories of tennis.
Ah, great memories. I'm interested to know, what was the 70-ounce nugget worth back in the day?
They picked up like over a couple of hundred pounds, which meant they could buy property. They could all buy musical instruments for the family, and they formed an orchestra. And they made ends meet during the Depression by being the dance group that went around all the country towns on Friday, Saturday night. So that's how the family then learnt their living. You know, my grandfather, my dad's father, was a blacksmith. You know, shoeing. And Dad had to leave school at 12 to shoe the horses and that. And he was so sad when he left school. And a difficult moment for my father was when I, you know, quit uni in first. Well, I wanted to quit uni in first year. I was doing science and at Melbourne, and I wanted to go play. Macca and everybody was over in Europe, and it was so hard for Dad because because he'd had to give up his education. Here was his son throwing away a degree, you know, to try and play tennis. So mum and dad made a deal with me. They said they'd let me defer if I toughed it out and started studying and finished my first year. Don't quit in the middle of first year university. You go finish that, son, you know. And so I toughed it out and did. And then I went to Europe, had that experience where I couldn't play at all on clay. So I went back and finished my science degree, actually, and was doing law as well when I then tried for the second time. But, you know, dad, it was very tough for him, to work three jobs to see the kids get an education and then, you know, me potentially be throwing it away. So they set the right boundaries for me at that time.
Mm. You're with This Is Your Sporting Life, brought to you by Tobin Brothers Funeral, celebrating lives. You can visit them at tobinbrothers.com.au. We'll be back with Paul McNamee right after this.
You're listening to This Is Your Sporting Life with Sam Edmund for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Welcome back to This Is Your Sporting Life for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Hello, we hope you're enjoying this week's edition of This Is Your Sporting Life. We're chatting with one of sport's great characters, Paul McNamee. Paul, coming back to on the court, you were spoken of anyway as the only player to switch your grip as a professional. You obviously went from a single-handed backhand to a double in 1979. How did that come about?
Yeah, that was mid-career, which you're right. No one else in history has done that. I wouldn't recommend it. It's pretty tough. It took me 10 hours a day for a while, 4 months. In Florida, 90-degree heat and 90% humidity. It was pretty tough. Yeah, but that was my big weakness, was my backhand, and I wanted to do, I went left field, you know. But I talk about this in Welcome to the Dance, is that the trap that many players make and many coaches make is they want to work on their weakness all the time. And you always find a coach, I can help you with your serve, I'll help you with your backhand if that's a problem. Whereas I point out that in life you should play to your strength. You know, you're doing SEN in sport not because you're better at politics, right? You know more about sport, right? So you play to your strength and be, you know, so don't just be good at your strengths, make them great. So for me, my forehand was my better shot growing up. But when I saw Borg and Vilas play the final of Nice, just ripping Western forehands like Nadal does now and high up in the net and not missing, I thought, I want to play like that. So I first changed my forehand and I made that into a weapon. So, you know, and same as you're going for a job, play to your strengths, you know. So I made my forehand a weapon, and that was the major transformation in my game, which made me a top 100 player initially and, you know, never to play qualifying again at a Grand Slam. Once I broke through with my forehand, I broke through. But getting stuck around 80 for a few years, I realized, well, you know, maybe I better, you know, now's the time to do something about my backhand. All the work I've done over the years hasn't worked. So I thought, well, I'll try and copy Bjorn on the back end as well. So I ended up copying Borg, same age as me, maybe even 6 months younger. I copied his forehand and then I copied his back end. And then that took a long while, and I nearly wasn't able to pull it off, but I did.
3 years later, of course, 82, you get your best Grand Slam result, that semi-final on the grass courts of Kooyong, of course. But it could have been more, couldn't it, Paul? I know we could say that about every person who bows out at the pointy end of a tournament. But you had a match point in that semi against the number one seed, the eventual winner, of course, the South African-born American Johan Kriek.
Yeah, and he was a top 10 player. I mean, it wasn't Australian Open that it is now, but he was a very, very good player. But I beat a young Pat Cash in the quarters, who was pretty handy on grass. Beat Chris Lewis and made the Wimbledon final the next year. So, I mean, I was playing really well that tournament, and I came from two sets of love down against Johan. I got to match point 5-3 in the fifth from two sets of love down, and on his serve I had match point. I had a short ball and I could have come in and I didn't. And, you know, as a coach, you know, not ruining the fact that I didn't take that opportunity and, you know, when that short ball comes to really rip it and go in and take your chance. I wasn't brave enough on that point. I think that's helped me as a coach, and I think I've helped Sue Wei Shea, who I coached, still a mentor now, being brave and, you know, in the way she plays now. And so I didn't take that match point, unfortunately. I mean, I didn't go in to the net. He ended up coming in and I ripped a pass. It would have been a winner on my match point. It hit the tape and fell back. I mean, if that goes over, I'm in the final of the Australian Open. And, you know, and that's life, you know. And I surfed the match the next game, got broken, c'est la vie. And, you know, Johan won it for the second year in a row. And that was the best I did. I was never good enough to be in contention more times at Grand Slams. I had big wins in Grand Slams, but I wasn't really good enough all round to be, you know, vying again. So, you know, that was my moment.
Yeah, but still, French Open fourth round, Wimbledon fourth round, US Open second round. So you get to 24 in the world ultimately. I mean, your prize money's nothing shabby. I mean, a shade over 1.2 million, but you must, Paul, have shaken your head over the years post your career as the prize money really took off.
Sure. Yeah, well, Mac and I won $9,000 each for winning Wimbledon, which is decent at the time. Because I bought an apartment in London for £36,000, you know, pounds. So, not, you know, $9,000 was a deposit on a house. It's not that bad, but now it's something like, you know, $400,000 each to win or something. I don't know, something like that. Yeah, well, I do know because I've helped Sue Way go to number one in the world in doubles. Yeah. So I kind of do know how much it is.
Hey, we joke. She's going beautifully. Hey, we joked earlier about it being impossible to fit your life into this show. Now, I wanted to ask you about mid-80s, 85 specifically. You underwent a serious kidney operation. There's a fair story around this to the point where I think at one point you're actually told to pack it in and retire, weren't you? Can you tell us about it? I think it flared up in a Davis Cup semi that year.
Oh, well, I had it at the end of 85. I mean, 85, I won that, actually got the semis, the doubles with Heinz Blumenthal. So Macra was out with his knee. And then Martina Navratilova and I won Wimbledon, which is great because my mother and father were there. And they kind of missed the years when Peter and I had won. So that was nice. And it was great playing with Martina. She's still a really close, good friend, you know, and a person I really respect. She's making the world a better place with all the causes she takes on. She's out there, as you would have noticed. So she's an amazing woman. So we're in the semis, and I knew they kind of needed me against Sweden in Sweden because it's on clay, and you know, with Macca not there, I was the best clay court player we had at the time, and you know, I really wanted to play the semi, but you know, the pain just got ridiculous when we're in getting ready in Spain. So I had to come back at the operation. And then, you know, the late Bob Brett, my God, you know, Bob Brett just passed away, who coached Macra and I for a while. And Brettie, I said, I'd like to come back after this kidney operation. And Brettie said, well, you need to go to the gym. And I would never love the gym, you know, too much. Still don't, to be honest. I didn't mind going for 10K warm down after a match, but I, you know, rip a couple of tens, no problem. But I didn't really love going to the gym. So Brettie said, if you go to the gym for a month, then I'll help you. And that was just torture for me. But I did that. And in 86, after that operation, I had my best singles ranking. I had, you know, top 10 wins in singles, especially on clay. And we won the Davis Cup that year. And I played singles in every tie, which is a big thing to do in four ties, you know, to play singles in every tie and winning Davis Cup team. I didn't play doubles that year. Fitzy and Cashy were the doubles team and Cashy and I played singles. So, yeah, look, it was just one of the, I just didn't want that to be the end of my career, having a kidney operation. And you know, so then, but once we won the Davis Cup and I had a good year, then I started thinking about retirement and what's next in life. And that's what happened.
Yeah, and it was another international tournament that you shaped earlier in your early foray into sports admin, wasn't it? And that was the Hotman Cup that you played a big role in founding in, what was that, 1988, I think?
Yeah, well, that's right. Well, I lost to Cashy third round of the Australian Open on Rod Laver Arena. I mean, that was an enormous honour to play on that court. The first year was at Melbourne Park. So I kind of hung on. I didn't even play doubles at the Australian Open. If I'm a doubles player, why didn't I play doubles in my last tournament? I didn't even play doubles. I just played singles. Played Cashy, third round, got beaten pretty badly. doesn't matter. And, you know, I got to play in Rod Laver Arena, and I got to be the guy that named it Rod Laver Arena, actually.
Yeah.
It was my idea to name it that, and get to tell Rod that it would be named after him. But the day after that, I mean, Pat Cash, Charlie Fanken and myself had been talking about it, and with, you know, it was Charlie's idea to do a mixed event that was like the Davis Cup and Federation Cup, it was called at the time, now the Billie Jean King Cup. And the Davis Cup's still called that, but it doesn't resemble what the one that we played, okay? We'll just go there. And so the very next day, went to an office on St Kilda Road. You know, my lady who would become my wife, you know, was helping us out, Leslie. And so she had to set up the office. So it was just, you know, that was amazing, amazing time. I went to work the day after I retired because we had this idea to have a tournament, no idea where it would be, you know, no idea, and end up in Perth. It's not there now, obviously, and I think there's imminent news that it will be resurrected from the grave again by the ITF. Charlie and I gave it to the ITF. We didn't sell it. We gave it to them, and it was tragic that it was discontinued, but I believe there's news coming out very soon that the Hopman Cup will be announced to be played somewhere in Europe, and we'll see.
Yeah, right. And this gets back to playing to your strengths, as you were saying too earlier, but you've been involved in the, obviously, post-career at the Australian Open. You've been tournament director in Turkey, Bulgaria. You work for Basketball Australia.
Golf.
And before, golf. And before Orica Green Edge came about, obviously, in the world of cycling, you were part of that push to field an Aussie team at the Tour de France as well.
You've been CEO at Melbourne Football Club.
You took the words right out of my mouth. So what was it about sports admin that drew you in, Paul?
I love sports admin, you know, and I've run 46 major events around the world now, which is not a few, and I just love the idea of the atmosphere that you can create. I mean, people say, as a tournament director, what do you do? I mean, yeah, you put out fires, and you know, you have some responsibility as a CEO. And certainly at the Australian Open, I was the CEO before Craig Trolley. There's a lot comes on your plate. But when I get asked, what do you actually do? And how did I see the role? And this is how I always answer it. My role was to create and to manage atmosphere, because atmosphere is the tonic for success, but it's an intangible. So the innate skill is how do you create atmosphere and how do you manage it? And for example, because it's a function of people and space. So, you know, if the second week there's less matches, you need to go to a smaller space to keep the atmosphere. And that's why even at Melbourne Football Club, I wanted them to have a secondary place to play out of Casey Fields. And if I'd have stayed there longer, they would have played more pre-season games, and they ultimately would have played an AFL game there, where they would have owned that whole southeastern corridor. And I, you know, it was very disappointing to see that they didn't really embrace Casey Fields.
We're talking to Paul McNamee on This Is Your Sporting Life, thanks to Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. We'll be back with Paul to talk Moomba and his fight to save that Mercedes coupe right after this.
You're listening to This Is Your Sporting Life with Sam Edmund for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Welcome back to This Is Your Sporting Life for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
It's been great to have your company here on This Is Your Sporting Life. Thanks to Tobin Brothers Funerals, a family-owned business since 1934. And Paul McNamee is our guest today. Paul, it's 1987 and you're the king of Moomba. Good one for the resume, I would have thought.
Well, it's an honour to be the one person, you know, plucked out of the, I don't know how many, 4 million people in Melbourne to be honoured, or Victoria honoured, as the King of Moomba. It was a big honour, no doubt about it. But you can't take it too seriously, because if you think life's about awards and recognition, you hopefully realise at some point it's not about that, and you know, the journey's within, and how you can try and be the best you can be, and it's nice to be honoured, but I don't take it seriously, no.
Yeah, that's fair enough. But one thing you did have to take seriously, and you weren't on your own here, a bomb around this time, a bomb went off in the South Yarra apartment block that you were living in. A bomb, really?
Yeah, I recognised it immediately. It was when I went off above, and unfortunately, you know, my neighbour was killed, and his wife was, had shocking injuries, and it was just horrendous. You know, I knew it was a bomb because when I heard the noise and through the curtain, there was just fire licking at the window. It was right above where I was sleeping. Luckily, the building was an old hospital, and it was so strong that the roof didn't collapse. And
yeah,
so I just got out of there, got in the laneway. What do you do? Everyone's running, going crazy, and then, you know, because around that time a lot of bombs were going off in Paris. So if you remember in that period, there was a bad period of things were happening. Terrorist things were happening in Europe, so I kind of realized there was that. It was shocking. Yeah.
Yeah, and you had to rescue something though from the downstairs garage first, though, didn't you?
I liked my car because I had a Merc at the time, and I'd got it in Stuttgart, and which actually the factory in Sindelfingen, and it was just an amazing experience collecting a Merc at headquarters in Sindelfingen. They're so proud the way that they do it. And they were sponsoring the tournament in Stuttgart. And Macca, myself and Chris Lewis all picked up a Mercedes on the same day, which was great. Different colours and whatever. And, so I ended up going to the US and eventually to Australia. The interesting thing, when I was in the US, right, because it was on its way to Australia, and of course, being Australian, cars are right-hand drive. Whereas in the US, of course, it's the other way around. So, I pull up at lights, and one time I was pulling up at lights, and these guys pulled up next to me, and they pulled the window down and said, "Hey, man," and I said, "What's the problem?" And they go, "Hey, man, they put that wheel on the wrong side of your car. You go take that car back where you bought that car, and you tell them they put that wheel on the wrong side. You make that put that wheel on the other side." This is the US we're talking about, okay? So so brought the car back, and I thought, whoever's done this bomb, this shock, whoever's planted this bomb, because I figured that's what happened, why let my car go down with everything else? So I just whipped in, just roared out. So I was in that red car speeding away from the scene, and then I realized, I might get implicated here, But yeah, so, what the heck? It was a tragedy.
Yeah. Your legacy, though, with tennis is everywhere. I mean, we spoke about, Rod Laver Arena after it was a national tennis centre around this time, but how did it come to be that the men's final was moved to a primetime night match in 05, which was, I think the first one, of course, was Leighton Hewitt, Marat Safin. You would have had your fingerprints all over that one as well.
Yes, because a few years before that, my dream was we'd have a primetime final because the AFL, they still haven't got around to it, And I thought, and no Grand Slam had a men's primetime singles final. And I thought, this is where we want to be. And I just had a hunch it'd be amazing. And when I took the idea to Channel 7, because I'm CEO of the Australian Open, they said, "Paul, you'll never live to see it." I mean, the Sunday night movies are iconic in Australia. That's the way Australian families. It's never going to happen. So then I had to figure out, well, how can I make it happen when the network that's covering the tournament says it will never happen? It means I have to secretly, clandestinely plan this way to get the final. So I sneaked the Thursday night semi in. And they sort of raised their eyebrows. And then I said, and I thought, if it rates well, I'd always put the half that would have hopefully the best semi on the Thursday night to rate well. And then I said, look, I didn't really think we should have both semis at night. So got the Friday night semi in. So now we've got the two semis at night. And then we were renegotiating the deal. And so I knew there was one. I knew they didn't want a night final, even though. And I said, I went to them, and they, we were doing the deal, and with Channel 7, and Bruce McWilliam was the guy, and he's I think he's still there, Bruce. He was a tough negotiator, and he said, "Is there anything else to get this deal done?" Because we just weren't quite there. And I said, "Well," I said, "Bruce, look," I said, "look, the players are saying," and because I was a player, I can say that always under good cover. "The players are saying that, with the semis being at night, the final really should be at night. And it really should be at night." So And he said, "Is that it?" I said, "Yeah, that's it." He said, "Okay, done." That was it. It felt like an apple off a tree. And of course, next year, I think you're going to see that it's possibly going to happen where the women's semis and final line up potentially. Don't know, but you know. So that was in my era in running the tournament. That was a massive moment. Of course, what happened was that year was the centenary Australian Open. You know, 1905 to 2005, Leighton was going on his run. Alicia Molik was playing well. And on Australia Day, Alicia played Venus Williams. And Leighton played Nadal, a young Nadal on that day, which was scheduled on Australia Day. And in Sydney, there were 75,000 people went to the Opera House to see the live site for the Australian Open. In Sydney, they had far more people watching the Australian Open on a screen than they did watching their tournament there. So it just cut through all things. And we had many matches, many nights rated over a million people. We had four of the top 10 TV shows in Australia happen during that tournament. And the final between Leighton and Marat Safin, you know, averaged over 4 million viewers. And until William and Kate's wedding was the highest rating television show in the history of Australian television. It outrated Cathy Freeman winning the Sydney Olympics and winning her gold medal. That show, it outrated it. So the first time we did it, and of course now it's just, well, of course, you know, it's going to be the Knights. And so that was personally for me as a goal as an administrator, very fulfilling as well. Probably the most fulfilling thing I did as an administrator, a bit like that Macron, you know, moment in Paris.
Yeah, yeah. And so just quickly on this, if you're sitting on the AFL Commission, Paul, you're barracking for a night grand final, aren't you?
Yeah, look, I am. What happens in Sydney, though, of course, with the NRL is they have a holiday on the Monday. So, you know, I would, if I was the AFL, I wouldn't have had the holiday on the Friday because with that parade that none of the players want to go to.
Yeah.
I mean, we're talking about Naomi Osaka and media conference. I mean, talk about a media thing that doesn't work for me. You know, I think that's a shocker to make the players do that. If the holiday was the Monday celebrating the AFL Grand Final, then it can be prime time because you haven't got school and all the other things the next morning. The thing they're worried about, you know, is that it can't be too late. But I think it could certainly be, you know, you could definitely go with a 7 p.m. Grand Final would be unbelievable. But I don't know. I think it's inevitable. Sure. Come on. It's inevitable.
Yeah. And just quickly, because we're running out of time, how do you reflect on that stint as that we touched on it earlier, as CEO of the AFL club, the Melbourne Demons in 08? I mean, you're in the seat for around 5 months. There were forces outside of your control at play there. It was a volatile time for the club, wasn't it?
Yeah. The thing that I'm sad about was that, you know, that Jonathan Brown was ready to come to the club. I mean, at the time, the best player in the competition. But, you know, the policy of the club was to go with young guys and recruiting that way. And I wanted to play finals. And I thought Jonathan Brown was critical. And
I hadn't heard that one, Paul.
Well, you know, no, that got a lot of play at the time because it looked like I was talking through my hat, right? And what happened when I got sacked on the footy show was you know, it was sort of a setup, which Sam Newman did very well, by the way. It was very funny the way he sent me up. But the thing was, you know, they got Jonathan Brown in and they asked Jonathan Brown, they said, "Well, do you know anything about this, you know, Melbourne Football Club possibility?" You know, because he wasn't getting on that well with Matthews at the time. And of course, soon after that, Michael Voss became the coach at Brisbane. And you know, and they asked him directly, has Paul McNamee ever spoken to you about this? And he said, no, which was true because I'm not dealing directly with Jonathan Brown. I mean, I was obviously talking with his manager. So, you know, that's the way it goes. So it looked like I was talking through my hat, but it was game on at that time. And look how long it's taken for Melbourne to be playing, you know, top-notch football. I mean, I think they should have been playing finals a decade ago, you know, a decade ago, and they didn't. So, you know, I didn't fit in there, and that's life. And you know, and sometimes you get sacked. That's what happens, right?
Nature of
the
beast.
You know, that was the thing. That was the thing I was sad about was that I do believe he would have come to the club.
Yeah,
I do believe.
Well, it's been great to have you on, Paul. I mean, you've got plenty keeping you busy in between your latest book. You're obviously running Paul McNamee Enterprises as well. I think you're a senior advisor for international relations for Tennis Australia. And what's the old saying? Sleep when you're dead, isn't it?
Well, yeah, look, I'm not going as hard as I used to because I'm at that stage of my life, but I love the opportunity to contribute to the sport. And to have that opportunity is great. And I thank Tennis Australia for that. And you know, I'm still helping Sue Way and still, you know, doing some. I've got to, I always have a few balls in the air. Yeah, Sam.
Well, I've got to say, Paul McNamee, it hasn't just been a pleasure. It's been inspirational to talk to you today. It was a rich career on the court, and it's very much been a rich career off it. You gave yourself over to the game of tennis all those years ago, but you've also given so much to the sport and the wider sporting community, it must be said, in the decades since. Well done on all you achieved and all you continue to achieve, mind you. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks, Sam. You're looking forward to the rest of today. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us also. You've been listening to This Is Your Sporting Life for Tobin Brothers Funerals Celebrating Lives. Jump online. You can find them at tobinbrothers.com.au. And we'll catch you the next time we celebrate the life of another sporting icon.